Session number 11478, William Gray, Reel 1.
Could you tell me, first of all, how you came to be in the 2nd Battalion, the Ox and Bucks Light Infantry, please?
When I was in the Kingsville Rifles, they came round asking for volunteers for airborne forces. Thinking it was paras, I volunteered for it. When I got to Bulford, I found out it was a glider battalion. And
would that have made any difference to your volunteering for it, if you'd have known?
No, I don't think so. It's only that nobody had heard of gliders before. We'd heard of paras because we'd seen a demonstration of the original paras dropping at Honington Airfield. And that's what put the idea into my head.
What was the training like?
Not too bad. We found it a bit hard after the Kingsville Rifles because we were all young soldiers and stationed on Honington Airfield, airfield defence. It was a pretty lackadaisical sort of unit.
In what way?
Well, we had very little PT. We were on guard almost all the time, you know, on perimeter defence, because at that time they were expecting sort of an attack on airfields. So we found it a bit harder when we got to the glider battalion, especially John Howard's company, because he was a physical nut.
How do you mean?
Well, he was all get up and run here, run there, and physical jerks. He was fit as a fiddle.
Did any of the volunteers have to drop out because of that?
Oh, yeah, there were some didn't pass through. You know, I suppose we were all on a sort of test for the first few weeks. All of a sudden, you find one or two were missing. You know, they had been returned to unit. So not all who volunteered stayed in.
Can you tell me about the specific training that you had for the Pegasus Bridge?
Well, the first we heard that we were going to do something like this was John Howard. He had us in the lecture room and said, we've been selected to do a specific job when the invasion comes. And he said, although I can't tell you much about it at the moment, you're going to attack two objectives. And on the backfield of the barracks, we're going to put out some tape to simulate these two objects, which we were going to attack.
Which barracks were these?
Wing barracks at Bulford, Wiltshire.
So he didn't say they were bridges?
No, not at that time, no.
What did the mock-ups look like?
Well, they were just tapes on the ground, long, narrow tapes. And I think after a week or two, which was quite intensive, just attacking these two lots of tapes, that he told us they were actually bridges. And from there, we went to a bridge. I don't know the name of the river, but it's at Ainsbury in Wiltshire. And we practiced, first of all, attacking the bridge and then swimming alongside the bridge, those of us who could swim, and pushing rubber boats across the river.
How good a swimmer were you?
I was pretty good. I was always, whenever we went swimming with the battalion or the company, Major Howard fancied himself as a champion breaststroke swimmer. And we were always in competition.
And the two of you?
Yes, yeah. And invariably I beat him on the breaststroke.
Now, you were in D Company 25 Platoon?
Yes.
Who were in charge of those?
Lieutenant Brotheridge. He was the platoon commander.
And in charge of the company was Howard?
Major John Howard, yeah.
Who was the senior sergeant in 25 Platoon?
Sergeant Hollis.
And you were a private then?
Yes.
What role was 25 Platoon supposed to carry out in the operation?
We were going to be the first to land and the first to attack the bridge. The three squads were each given an individual task. My own squad was detailed to go over the right-hand side of the bridge and attack anyone we saw going over.
Who was in charge of that squad?
Corporal Kane.
Corporal who?
Kane, C-A-I-N.
Were the glider? Did the gliders have numbers or letters or names?
Number one glider I was in. They were numbered 1 to 6.
Did you get to know the pilots, the crew of the glider?
No, never saw the glider pilots before we took off. Or I didn't personally. I suppose the officers did, and saw very very little of them after we landed because they stayed with the gliders and. Manhandled the equipment off.
How long did the training and preparation for the operation take from your point of view?
I would say about 6 weeks before the 6th of June we started. I think it was about 6 weeks, yeah.
What did you feel about that training period? Do you think it prepared you adequately for what was to
come?
Oh,
yes. Yeah, we knew exactly what we had to do. You know, we trained and practiced it so often that we knew it like the back of a hand. You know, anyone could have taken each other's place in the... You know, each individual soldier knew exactly what he was going to do or supposed to do on the night. And it worked out that way, too. You know, we were, when we landed, we practiced the landings, and I was a Bren gunner, so that was the main weapon on the glider, and it was my job to be first out of the glider to supply the all-round protection while everybody else got out.
Were there any hitches or accidents in the training?
No, not to my knowledge.
Where else did you go on the training besides Amesbury?
We went to two bridges across the river and a canal, I believe, down near Bristol, which were approximately the same distances apart as the ones in Normandy. We practiced on them and then decided if we couldn't get across the bridge, somebody would have to swim across it, and all of us who were swimmers were detailed that that's what we might have to do. Whether we'd have ever done it, I don't know, but we were detailed, you know, that's what we'd have to do, is swim across the canal to get to the other side, if the bridge was blown, for instance, when we got there.
In what kind of spirit did you all approach the operation? Were you frightened and apprehensive, or looking forward to it, or excited? Or
well,
what?
That's what I can never understand. Everyone was so smashing, you know, let's have a bash and that. In fact, the glider was overweight for a start, and we either had to dump some ammo or dump a man off. And Major Howard decided, right, we'd drop a man off. So he came round and he said, someone will have to drop out. Who's going to volunteer? Nobody volunteered. I did suggest Wally Parr, who was a friend of mine in the platoon, because he was married. He went berserk and said, not me, you know, I'm going. And in the end, because he couldn't get a volunteer, we all went. I believe they dropped off a bit of ammo, but the glider was grossly overweighted.
So people didn't volunteer to drop out because
They would have felt ashamed to drop out in front of their comrades.
Oh, no, no. Is that they all wanted to go.
What equipment did you take? What did you look like as you got into the glider?
Well, we had flying smocks, helmets, faces blacked out. We carried our red berets in case we needed to put them on for recognition purposes. I personally had a Bren gun and about six magazines, three or four grenades, a small pack, pretty well weighed down, loads of weight. In fact, we had a job to haul ourselves off the ground to get into the gliders. We had so much weight.
What do you remember about the night before?
Being issued with French francs, playing cards and losing a lot.
Losing all the French
francs?
All
the French francs, yes. But everyone was so excited, if you like, you know, just wanting to get cracking and get on with it.
When was it revealed to you that it was going to be Normandy and the Pegasus Bridge?
The day before D-Day, when it was postponed. We'd already been told what it was and then it was postponed. But it didn't mean a lot. You know, they said it was the Caen Canal and it was in Normandy at that time. It didn't mean a lot to anyone. You know, nobody had ever been to France. In fact, very few had been abroad at that time.
Had you been abroad?
No, I hadn't.
Had you been in action before?
No.
Now, can you take me through the flight to Normandy and the landing and the operation, step by step in detail, as you remember it, please?
Well, I can remember getting in the trucks at the camp we were based at, and the blinds being drawn at the back, and then pulling into Tarrant Rushton airfield just as it was getting dark at dusk, going straight away towards the gliders in the trucks with the WAFs and the NAFI girls all lining the runway, mostly crying their eyes out and waving.
Was that because they'd got to know you?
No, they never knew us, no, but obviously they knew something was afoot because the Tarrant Rushton was absolutely jam-packed with aircraft like Halifax bombers and the Horsa gliders. Going up to the glider, getting off the lorry, and then the platoon commanders doing their normal bit, you know, hollering and shouting, get in line and don't forget what position you've got in the glider. And eventually we all, what they used to call, emplaned. And sat down and strapped ourselves in.
What did it look like inside the glider?
Well, they're very sparse, you know, it's just plywood. And the bench seats each side. You could look at, there were small windows in the side, little round windows you could see, and if you were near the front of the aircraft, which I was, you could see through the pilot's windscreen. You know, you could see over a pilot's shoulder and what's going on out in front. And with that, just close the doors. Somebody said, probably John Howard, we're off. And the old Halifax, you could hear the old engines roaring away, and the old tug. And up went the glider behind the Halifax. Immediately everybody started singing. You wouldn't believe it, but they were all singing, and if they could have got up and danced, they would have danced.
What were they singing?
Oh, Roll Out the Barrel. But we're all Londoners. The vast majority of us in there were Londoners, and they were all the old London songs. Yeah, I can't think of them at the moment. aren't forever blowing bubbles and that sort of thing, you know. And you could just about make out Bournemouth when we passed over Bournemouth, and then you could see the sea. And after about 20 minutes or so, you could see the German AKAC firing at, not at us, but at somebody else over to the right. And then you could see us passing over the coast, and we were still all singing. And suddenly you heard the bang, which denoted that the glider had separated from the tow plane. Then everything goes quiet. And John Howard shouting out, "Be quiet, or Jerry will hear us." You know, it was so quiet in the glider once you towed off that they probably could have done, because it was so noisy in this glider. And then the glider was twisting and turning a bit, and just looking through the over the pilot's shoulder, you could see the bridge, and it was exactly like the model we'd been shown previously. And couldn't believe it, you know, the pilot was there. And then it vanished, you know, as the glider sort of veered to make its approach to the landing. And the next thing, crash, as it hit the deck, and then sparks flying left, right and centre. And all of a sudden it just came to a halt and silence again, just a creaking of some sort of timber in the glider. And the undercarriage had gone, of course, and the front of the glider was stove in. And Danny Brotheridge, who was our platoon commander, he quickly slid open the door and said, "Gun out," which was me. And out I jumped, stumbled on the grass because of the weight I had, and set the Bren up facing the bridge, and the rest of the lads sort of jumped out. Danny Brotheridge just got in front of me. Then he looked round to make sure that everybody was out and said, "Come on, lads," and up we got. And we were about 30 yards from the bridge, I suppose, and we dashed towards it, and I saw a German on the right hand side, and let rip at him, and you know, and down he went. And then still, oh, before that though, Tom Packwood, who was me number two, got in front of me, and he stopped and said, "Come on, Bill, you're supposed to be in front of me, because with the Bren gun." And having shot the first German, I still kept firing going over the bridge. And at the other side, there was another German, and he went down. And my job, once we got over the bridge, was to turn half right where there was a barn, was a building, which we still can't figure out what it was. But my job was to clear it. But at the time, I was breaking my neck to go to the toilet, and with all the equipment on, you know, I couldn't undo it all. And I went to the door of the barn, swung in a 36 grenade, and given the rest of the magazine, and went inside, and there was nobody in there. And there was a lot of firing going on outside, and the other side, the bridge. And when I came out, somebody started firing from down the road, a Smyzer, you know, it's the unmistakable sound of a Smyzer. And so I let rip with a Bren, and then dashed across the road where I saw Danny Brotheridge, who had got killed, just the other side of the bridge. And I dashed up this small slope to a little field where there was a German gun pit, which was designated as our place to defend. You know, we'd seen it in air photographs, so we knew exactly where we were going. And everything worked just a plan. You know, it was all over then, barring the shouting. You know, there was a few prisoners we had, and odd bursts of firing from behind us, because half of the platoon and the rest of the company were clearing the near side of the canal where the gliders had landed. In fact, our platoon was the only one over the far side at that time. And when it was cleared on the glider side, they all, or half of them, came over and went to their positions where we were. It got a bit quiet for a time. There was one funny little incident. Where our gun pit was right beside the edge of a sort of cliff. It was the canal path was on the sort of water level, and then to get to our gun pit, you had to climb this cliff, which was about 25 foot high. And while we were looking out to our front, we heard a noise coming up the side of the cliff. And me being a brain gunner, my personal weapon was a 45 Colt revolver. And I just drew the revolver and said, "Leave him with me." And the head just stuck over the top of the cliff. And I was just going to pull the trigger, and I realised it was one of our own blokes who had got lost and decided. So there was a bit of a laugh at that, you know, and things got a bit quiet. And after, I don't know how long, say half an hour, there was more firing from our front, and then the sound of a tank coming down the road. And we could see it quite clearly, this big tank and German infantry beside us, beside the tank. And Cobber Kane, who was our section commander, said, "Hold your fire," which we did. And all of a sudden we heard a bang, and somebody had fired a pit from the opposite side of the road and set fire to the tank. We opened up on the infantry, and they just dashed back onto the crossroads where they'd come from. And then for about half an hour after that, all you could hear was the ammunition exploding in the this tank, until we heard running feet behind us, and it was the 7th Para Battalion, or their advance guard, who had reached us, and they went through us. And there was a bit of rejoicing, you know, when they saw that we had taken the bridge, and they didn't have the trouble of taking it, because that was their job. If we hadn't taken it, they were going to have a go. And they just went past, patting us on our helmets, you know, saying, "Good lads, well done." And away they went through to a little village called Benneville, which they cleared. And then through the night, there was sort of little probing attacks, I suppose, by Germans, and never got too close to us. And our particular section was relieved and told to go back the other side of the bridge into this gun pit where there's a 75mm German gun. And we went and took charge of that. And just about as dawn was breaking, we heard the footsteps marching along the road towards the bridge. And it was General Gale, Brigadier Kindersley, who were just walking along there as if they was blinking umpires at a skiing. You know, so cool, calm and collected. And old Windy Gale just looked down at us there and just said, "Well done, lads," and that was it, you know. Because then come daylight, I don't really know, we've kept awake all the time, because we'd been awake most of the night previously, and obviously all day on the 5th of June, and then all night on the 6th, and we were still quite lively the next morning, you know, and all during the day then we were just going backwards and forwards each side of the bridge, running a bit low on ammo by then, because, I mean, the Bren had been firing almost continually for, well, 15 or 16 hours, and we went up to a little village called La Porte, where Jerry had almost broken through the 7th Para, and we helped them out there. And it was while we was in La Porte that we heard sound of bagpipes. And the firing all stopped. You know, it was noisy, what with us firing at Jerry and Jerry firing at us. And then you could hear the bagpipes. And then the sort of sound what a tank make, you know, unmistakable sound of a tank. Then along the road up from the beaches, there was Lord Lovett with his piper and this dirty great Churchill tank. And because once they had reached this village, La Porte, Jerry just seemed to vanish from that particular side. And they turned left down the road towards the bridge. And they were being sniped at continuously. And we were firing from a bit high up near the churchyard in La Porte, firing across the bridge into the trees where we suspected the snipers were. We couldn't see them, but we just did all we could to help the commandos get across the bridge. But they were under quite heavy fire, you know, and we saw loads of commandos killed there, just ducking to get across to the other side.
Did the commandos come in any kind of reckless way or taking cover?
No, they were taking cover. They were in single file and, you know, dashing across in sections from one side of the bridge, the end we were, across to the other side. But they were still getting quite heavy casualties there. And I saw them from my position where I was. They set up the Vickers on the corner of the bridge and were spraying the trees alongside the canal. That was the actual side where the gliders had landed. In fact, I've heard since that some snipers had got in amongst the three gliders and they were using that as cover, you know, to fire on. But it's quite, at that time, quite heavily wooded there. You know, the trees were in full leaf. And I suppose these snipers were up in the trees. But although you could hear them and, you know, you had to keep your head down and they were firing at us, you just couldn't see them. And we never did catch any of them. And after that, when the commandos went through, Jerry started his attacks again because the commandos went right through and out the other side and across the River Orne Bridge. And Jerry started his attacks again. And then again, things went quiet. And you heard this sound of aircraft engines. And when we looked up, it was the rest of our battalion being towed in, you know, and they landed about a mile from where we were. And by the time they had sort of grouped and came towards the bridge, or the opposition had sort of petered out.
What kind of duties did you take up after that?
We just... what did we do? We just stayed in the trenches, watching out, you know, waiting all the time for any attacks which might come, and then it gradually got dark, and the rest of the battalion had gone through us. I believe it was the 3rd British Infantry Div came up and they took over the bridge and we left it with those and went to join the rest of the battalion. When we found them, I believe